Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Stargate Voyager.
I think we're looking again at a lost technology. And it was this ancient apocalypse 12,800 years ago that wiped that from the human memory banks.
Why were these ancient elongated skulled peoples or humanoids of Malta living underground?
Now I believe we're talking prior to 9700 BC for the original construction of the Sphinx.
And they were what some people have called giants, probably no more than 7 to 8 feet tall. And those giants have been pulled out of American mounds.
Whether it's the colossal statue heads that have been unearthed, to all the strange artifacts you've been showing in the museums, to some of the strange features they seem to possess, the more I learn about the Olmec culture, really the more fascinated I become. Well, I am super pumped to be joined by Michael Collins today, aka otherwise known as Wandering Wolf on social media, on YouTube, Instagram, X. So definitely follow him there. Michael, thanks so much for joining me, man.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, I think I've been following you for a couple years now online on YouTube, Instagram, all the places, and really have just enjoyed the content you've been putting out, especially a lot of your drone footage that you get at these ancient sites, because like me, you're a fellow ancient history researcher among many things, filmmaker. And then I think what caught my attention last year, the year before, was when you were posting stuff about the Montana megaliths, or the so-called Montana megaliths and the Sage Wall. And I messaged you and you were like, I asked you if I could post, I think, footage of your Sage Wall. And that kind of went viral on my channel. And then next thing I know, I think you were doing something with Jimmy Corsetti, which was really cool. So, dude, welcome to my podcast, and love your work. And tell us a little bit about how you got into this world of using your skills with video and film and drone to photograph and capture and research all this ancient stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, the feeling's mutual. Thank you for all of the kind words, man. I've been following your stuff for a long time. And when you reached out to me, it was a pleasure to share all that footage and do that together. Montana kind of, you know, kicked things off for me with all this work and with the drone footage and stuff. I don't know, in the film work, if I would say if it's great sometimes, but I'm able to get it and get out to these locations, which is kind of learning as I've been going for the last several years, 4 or 5 years now. So really, obviously I love hitting the big spots, but I love getting out to places that nobody else really gets to or people haven't seen yet. That really motivates me quite a bit. And I know that Sage Wall had been covered before, but I had never seen any drone footage, and I knew I had to get up there and get that just to get a perspective on it, because it felt like there was something worth seeing there. And funny enough, I was planning on going to Russia to go to Gornaya Shoria. So that was the plan, and that had been in the works for like 6 months, and then everything with Ukraine kicked off, and that whole trip had to be scrapped until I could figure out how things were going to, you know, pan out there. And so Sage Wall popped up, and I just immediately jumped on that, went out there and filmed that. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. I've been up there twice now, and there's research going on up there. The site and property owner, Chris and Linda, have been working with geologists, the geophysicists, taking readings up there. So there's been a lot of cool stuff coming out over the past year. And they're looking to continue that this year. I'm hoping to go back up there and just see what all they're doing, getting some LIDAR. They've already done ground penetrating radar. We've established that the wall is highly magnetic. You can throw a magnet on it and it just sticks to the wall. So a lot of really interesting things going on up there. And hopefully we just keep finding it's a lot of circumstantial stuff too there, you know, like marks in the stones and different stuff like that all over the place. I feel kind of reinforced that need to investigate further, regardless of the outcome. I feel like it warrants that. It's a very interesting site for sure.
Yeah, it really is. It's one of these really seems like highly debated sites. You've got one camp that says this is just pure natural exotic formations, and then the other camp that's like, no, these are just super weathered ancient megaliths. And I remember seeing the photographs of this, man, a long time ago now, maybe 6-7 years, and I did a blog post on it with some others who had been out there and taken photographs. But then again, when you see the video footage and the drone footage, it takes it to a whole new level. And I personally have not been there yet. But just want to talk to you a little bit more about this mysterious Montana megalith site, because you've got kind of, to me, the main feature, which seems to be the Sage Wall, as you and others call it, which looks like this massive wall, you know, that goes left to right, and it's got to be at least 10 foot tall. And then you've got these other phenomena that I think they call it the Tizer Dolmen. And there's other so-called, you know, dolmen-like structures that, man, at first glance look like this is a massive ancient dolmen, the way there's, you know, a slab on top of like three massive stones, right? Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on seeing Sage Wall up close and then these dolmens. What were you noticing?
Well, Sage Wall, it's the straightness of it. When you know, that is so, you know, the other side wants to, you know, attribute it to as a volcanic dike or a natural formation. And, you know, I've tried to find anything else in terms of that type of geological formation that looks similar to the Sage Wall, have not been able to find anything that remotely looks similar. I happen to believe that if it is man-made, it's so old that we have a combination of man working the stone and also natural erosion and weathering. So you do have some cracks coming down the entire length of the wall that don't look like that would be practical at all for any kind of stability. But what I think we're seeing there is cracking of the stone from, you know, potentially thousands of years of weathering and erosion. So I think we have a combination of two things going on there. If it's man-made, if it's not, we're still doing the research and providing information that was before this unknown. The property owner, like I mentioned before, Chris and Linda, they own that land. So whereas a lot of the other sites in Montana are pretty much all on BLM land, this is on private land, which is one of the main reasons why I've specifically focused on that site, because we can actually do work and like they're doing up there right now, document these things, get results, and present them to people. Whereas the other sites, there's a whole list of, you know, red tape and stuff that you have to go through for anything like that. Tizer Dolmen is very unique and interesting. It pops out of the trees out of nowhere. You're walking and looking around for this thing your first time going there, and then all of a sudden it's just there. It's pretty amazing. It's this massive, massive thing. It doesn't have very typical features of the average dolmen. Now, there are only two blocks, and I have identified up there, which may be a bummer to a lot of people, how the rock has had a boulder roll into the back of it and crack it. So part of it is split off on the side, and that may be responsible for the separation between the two pieces under that capstone and that break there. But as far as the piece on top, how that's quite explained, I'm still kind of unsure about that. There's a lot of potential at some of these sites up there for man-made influence on a lot of different areas in the region that, again, are so old that there is just a huge amount of erosion and natural weathering that has happened there. So I think the best thing that we can do is keep documenting, keep researching and working theories. I think that that's the way to go. And I think Sage Wall there, Chris and Linda are really leading that charge there. I'm happy. I've been such a pleasure to be able to go there and document it, but they're really doing the on the ground tough work of keeping that area cleared, maintained, allowing people on into their home basically, because they live there. But it's a really unique area, and I hope here pretty soon to put out a video that shares all the exact locations, because all of this except Sage Wall is on public land. So you can go up there and visit, and you can walk out and see any of these sites yourself and enjoy them. And a lot of them are just right off the road, like at Giant's Playground, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, that's interesting that you said a large portion of the sites on this private land owned by this couple, which is probably why this site is, it's the news has been able to get out there, right? It's not so controlled and shut down and everything shut down. Cause I feel like if it was BLM land, like you were saying, it'd probably be a lot harder to get up there. They'd probably have it all off limits, right?
As of right now, these sites are pretty accessible, but you're definitely on the right track here. I recently kind of compiled everything into one video a couple months ago, the story of Sage Wall, Megaliths in Montana. And you do have some interesting things going on there, like, you know, within the last few years, as it's gained attention in the public eye, Montana has signed mineral rights or decided to pursue mineral rights and developments up in Montana. And the company that they hired for that is a company called Rio Tinto. Now, Rio Tinto is a multinational company, and they operate all over the world. And one of the areas that they have of particular note that they've worked in is Australia, where they have destroyed ancient sites in Australia. They have straight up dynamited ancient sites in Australia, and they have a reputation for destroying ancient sites. And I find it very interesting, and I go into that in a bit more detail in the video about this company and their involvement in ancient sites around the world. I find it very interesting that all of a sudden Sage Wall comes into the public eye, and this company gets a tap on the shoulder, and now there's black helicopters flying around the property up there and over the BML land. All the people up there, Chris and Linda, the owners of the property, and different people got notices. And luckily, all of the Sage Wall and some of this is on their private land, but they back up to BLM land. So they've got black helicopters flying all over their property for the last year. I find that very, very interesting. Right as a lot of this stuff is kind of coming more into the public eye.
Yeah, that's nuts. Exactly. Yeah. Right after the news is really getting out there, mm-hmm. black helicopters over the site. That's crazy.
Yeah.
I guess so, if they ended up destroying the site, then we'd probably know the answer to was it megalithic or not, right?
That would be the camp that I would fall in. I think we're both in that camp, right? You know, it's so, you know, a lot of this, there's a lot more videos coming out now on sites from up there, which is great. I'm super supportive and encouraging of other content creators and people putting out as much as we can about all of these sites and places and getting it more into the public eye and public awareness and putting these the locations and stuff out there for people to visit and spend time at so that, you know, if something like that happened, there would be the amount of pushback needed to potentially kind of stop something like what they, you know, this company Rio Tinto is known for in Australia. They've destroyed hundreds of sites in Australia.
I think it was one of your photos you might have shared at some point on X. And if anyone's on Twitter or X, make sure and follow Michael at Wandering Wolf. Great account where you're going to see a lot of this stuff we're talking about. But again, this site is, you know, it's always, is it natural? Is it, or is this ancient architecture? And, you know, I've kind of gone back and forth over the years, and just, it's like, just when I was maybe starting to lean towards its more natural formations, I saw this photo, and I think it was from you, so I want to ask you about it.
Yeah.
Of what looked like flat-out knobs, like you'd see knobs or nubs you'd see in Peru or Egypt on the exterior of one of these structures. I don't know if it was sage wall or if it was around one of these so-called dolmens, but there was literally like three knobs or nubs in a row. Was that you?
Yeah, I definitely highlighted that. That is at... Tizer Dolmen.
Okay.
So as you get to the dolmen, you can actually walk up right up the side of the dolmen. And that takes you to a higher level on a rise that goes up. And there's a lot of really interesting rock formations up on that ridge. So if you just stay towards the center of that as you go back, there's a wall back there. And those three nubs are on that wall. And, you know, a lot of people call these nubs different stuff. You know, if you're in an ancient site, let's say you're at Baalbek or something and you see nubs, they're nubs, right? So where it gets difficult, you know, they were put there for intentionally. Now, when you start getting out to places like Montana and you look at nubs, again, you've got the people on the natural side of things. You know, these are inclusions or, you know, and you are in a batholith. Boulder batholith is the entire region there that all this exists in, right? But it's the alignment of those nubs that's really eye-catching. And I've done measurements and I show those in videos between that are, they're almost perfectly spaced. Now the rock cracks in between two and one of them, if I remember correctly. So you do have to factor in for that, the where the rock is split. But yeah, they're just in this alignment together that really catches your eye, especially if you've been looking at ancient sites around the world for a long time. This is definitely something that would just stand out to you, right?
Yeah, yeah. Again, it's not one, it's not two, it's at least three. Of these nubs, like you said, aligned, mm-hmm. that looks like this is an intentional architecture or engineering, you know, from the ages past. So right. Any final thoughts, Michael, on the whole Montana megaliths? It sounds like, gun to your head, you think this is ancient architecture, correct?
Man, gun to my head. I think that this is an area that needs to continue to be documented and researched. And I think it has the potential for showing human influence on these sites and these areas. And I would also just say that if you spend any time looking into potential megaliths in the Americas, North America, things that would be considered and to have human influence and be researched anywhere else in the world, if you found it, are completely dismissed here in North America, just out of hand, factually. It's, you know, is how, whether it's dolmens, walls like this, you know, there's all sorts of things worth investigating that just are completely dismissed out of hand. And Montana definitely has so many different features in such a small area that I would say, hugely tip it over into the realm of needing further research and being worth exploring. So, yeah.
I like the way you put that. It has the potential for human influence. Well, let's talk about your trip to Peru, because you were just there and was enjoying a lot of your posts. And I know you've probably got, like me, just a million video files to post in the future, right?
Yeah.
But I was just there in October, so it's still kind of fresh in my mind, but kind of give me highlight of your trip, overall thoughts, and then I want to ask you about this Band of Holes site that you took a cool video at.
Absolutely. Peru may be one of my favorite places in the world. And it's the first place that when I started doing all this that I went to film. So unfortunately, on that first trip, it got the short end of the stick. I had no idea what I was doing. And there was so much that I didn't know I was looking at compared to now and visiting here recently. So it was amazing. It was amazing to see Sacsayhuamán with fresh eyes. It was amazing to see all these different places and go to and see stuff that I had seen before but didn't really at the time have the level of awareness that I do now to pick up on things. And so it was such a fun trip. And I was able to connect with Will from Incredible History down there, who's putting out amazing work. I mean, his level of in-depthness and research into the topics that he focuses on is just awesome. So we were able to work together down there, and it was really cool. I loved it. I mean, you could spend weeks in just Cusco,
right?
And not go anywhere else in the country. And if you're all about seeing ancient sites and megaliths, it's, you know, you're going to be a kid in a candy shop. It's just incredible. So, you can visit some of these sites multiple times and you'll see stuff that you missed and never saw before. You know, one of the big things that I picked up on this time around was the, more than any other place I think I've visited in the world, Peru has these examples of what looked like geopolymer, looks like poured stone, the way they're just so fitted. And then you see these markings on the blocks that look like the stone was scraped and then, but not completely smoothed over. You have things like nubs, you have small nubs, big nubs, nubs in different shapes. You have, you know, inverted nubs, or, you know, I don't even know what you call those, that almost look like they're spots for forklifts to come in and grab. And the way that you have curved corners with stones that look like they were poured in place. You have things like Coricacha, what looks like code written on the wall in nubs, and you know, these different examples of still perfectly fitted blocks, but they're just completely square and stuff, unlike Sacsayhuamán or just down the road where you find the 12-angled stone on the streets of Cusco. So you have all these different examples of stoneworking on a megalithic scale. And it's really a place that invites you to just really be creative in your mode of thought when it comes to comparisons to other stuff around the world. Peru is almost like a blueprint for the world, the rest of the world, when it comes to understanding megaliths and ancient sites.
Yeah, Peru is, like you said, you could just stay around the Cusco and not go anywhere else, and you'd have unlimited stuff to do for a week or two. I went, this was my second trip this last October. First time I went was in 2017. And this time around, you know, I saw new stuff, like you said, in the highlands above Cusco. I could have just been there days and weeks. Yeah. And that was the favorite part for me of my last trip, was just kind of going, not to any of the big known, more known sites, but just exploring in these highlands and all of the anomalies that you'd find, like all of these, you know, the Inca, so-called Inca sacred sites that I think predated the Inca, but just precision cuts in almost everything, just everywhere. It was unbelievable. It was like, it was so easy for them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like they were showing off in some of the stuff. and you were dropping pics, I was following along, that of stuff that I'd never seen before. And it looked like you were just walking up into the hills and finding things.
Yeah.
And that's just amazing, man. I mean, there's so much stuff up there that isn't on a, you're not going to find it on Google Maps, but you just walk up to it.
Yeah.
It is pretty much like a place where they were just showing off about their ability in terms of creating some of these walls and structures. And the juxtaposition of ancient construction mixed with modern life in the city of Cusco is wild. It's like, you know, you got Starbucks on top of megalithic walls, and you know, it's like, what is going on here? But
I think Cusco might be one of the only places in the world where downtown in a pretty major city, you can, like you said, you can sit and drink coffee alongside megalithic walls where the rest, where modern day buildings are built on top of. It is unreal that that these were so cataclysmic proof. They're still there and the city's built on top of them.
Right.
And isn't it wild how you see the layers of civilization? So you've got the megaliths on the bottom, and then you see Inca above that. Mm-hmm. And then Spanish on that, and then today on top of that.
That's so awesome. There's a corner when you're walking down the little pathway there with the 12 angled stone in the city. There's a church there now. And you go down it and you walk down those steps and go down around the corner, which not everybody does. And you go walk around the other side because it all keeps going. It's like one whole block right there, but you can see all those examples that you're talking about so clearly. And there's such a difference from layer to layer in terms of skill that's so apparent. And it's for someone like me, and I'm sure for you, seeing that, it's more proof that, you know, the history that we have isn't the history that's true, and it's worth, you know, continuing to work to uncover these, you know, these mysteries, these ideas, these understandings of history. And when you see it just so clear as day laid out like that, it's really fascinating to just see how progressively more primitive it seems like we get as we've gone along until now. Which is, you know, amazing. We don't make anything that lasts anymore. So, you know, if we disappeared off the earth right now, the only thing that would still be standing probably in 1,000 years would be these still ancient structures from thousands and thousands of years before us. Cause the skyscrapers and everything else downtown and all that, they'd just collapse and crumble. They'd be gone.
No comparison, right, to the anti-seismic megaton, 100-ton blocks that you see, like you said, at Sacsayhuaman. So did you have a favorite site or an aha moment when you were in Peru?
Well, the Band of Holes.
Talk about that. And tell viewers and listeners what that exactly is.
Absolutely. Band of Holes is a site out in Peru. It's Ica. It's near Ica. And so it's not up in the Andes. It's out close to the coast. And it was discovered in like 1933. And there's been all kinds of ideas proposed around what it was for. So it's like 5,000 to 6,000 holes stretching for I believe a mile or two from where the hills come down into this river valley up onto this mountain. Now, the most accepted ideas thus far have been graves, originally, tribute holes, for collecting things like grain and different stuff during the Incan Empire, even to defensive positions, and some of the more far out theories as being giant machines that had tread that were rolling around, but, you know, without getting into all that. The reason I was so excited about this site is it's been unexplained for almost 100 years now. And the best that we've got is tribute holes or graves, right? And thus far, finding nothing to back any of that up. So these are just ideas. And the site has been researched by many archaeologists over the years. And they all have those same different opinions varying from one to the other. Now, a while back, I was just scrolling on Facebook and there was an article on agricultural methods used in the Canary Islands. And one of those pictures just caught my eye, and I think I had been prepping to go to Peru, and I said, that's it right there. That's exactly what this looks like. And so I started doing comparisons, and then by the time I was ready to get down to Peru, I'd really worked out this theory, started presenting it online, and that was really what I wanted to focus on this trip, was going there, documenting the band of holes, getting up close and seeing the holes, seeing how they're formed, seeing how they were worked. If they were used for agriculture, these areas that are using this type of agricultural technique, specifically in the Canary Islands, they're doing it to protect against things like wind and areas that are extremely dusty where it can damage the crops. Lack of precipitation, because the way that they're formed, they can collect and hold water and let it seep into the ground, thereby making the area more usable for agriculture. And Peru has examples of them basically terraforming their environment for agricultural use all over the country. Everywhere you go, there's terraces. They have intricate irrigation systems set up all over the place. You can find examples of this all over. So they just felt like this fit really well. And when I got out there, I really felt like looking at these holes just further confirmed that theory for me, which is that I feel like they were planting some type of crop there. We know that when you go down into the valley, it's still used as farmland today down below those hills. So these holes and half circles seem like they would all function extremely well for something like agriculture. Maybe even stuff like trees or things like, in the Canary Islands, are used for vineyards. They grow grapes. These are all wineries out there. I don't necessarily think it was for that, but some type of crop that maybe was better in that more elevated area. And so I will be going to the Canary Islands here in just a couple weeks to further document the agricultural methods being used over in the Canary Islands, to look at that as well, and get these close-up shots and interview a few specialists over there, and get their opinions and talk to people and hopefully do a really good comparison video of the site, because I think that this is, in my opinion, the best now theory for what that site was used for, as opposed to the prevailing theories thus far, like graves and tribute holes, because I just don't feel like it adds up the way that they're situated and spaced. You can walk between them, but if they were tribute holes, it seems like you would more likely build things that are have paths and a bit more organized. And the same type of thing with graves. They go in alternating rows of 9 and 7, if I remember correctly. I don't remember, but it was like, it's odd. And yeah, it just seems a bit too generalized for some of those purposes. And for the tribute stuff, there's 6,000 holes. So it's just, why stretch it up into the mountain? So for something like that would be used on a regular basis by people. So yeah, this is definitely the project I'm working on that I'm the most excited about. I'll probably keep going, but I'll take a breather here to get detailed in that.
No, great video footage you captured. And isn't that pretty close to Nazca?
Fairly close. It's, if I remember correctly, 2 or 3 hours.
Okay.
But doable in a day. We stayed at Huacachina, the desert oasis, and went out to Nazca lines. And then that was a few hour drive. And then from Huacachina to the Band of Holes was like an hour and a half or so. So,
yeah, I mean, like you mentioned terraforming, it's crazy when you're driving around Peru and you're looking up into the hills and it's like, I mean, you're in the Andes. These are epic giant mountains.
Yeah.
And in some of the highest spots you see, even if it's not like being modern day used, you can see the traces where it was once used at the tip tops of some of these peaks. And you're going, how in the world? Yeah. Was that even feasible? But again, they made it look easy. And so I even theorize with some of the, I was theorizing with some of the guys on my last tour. Again, the Inca were great engineers in their own day, in their own right, and did incredible terracing, right? Yet at some of these sites like Pisac, I don't know if you went there, but
that's true.
A lot of these sites, you see different styles of this, the terracing.
Right.
And there's some that look far more giant and older, and you even see megalithic blocks in there versus what would probably be the Inca that were trying to replicate that later.
Yeah.
And so I theorize that these ancient engineers who are building the likes of the Sacsayhuaman and these other sites, they were terracing in their day too. And it was their original idea. And the, I think probably what we see in the tip-top peaks was them too.
I have to agree with that. I think, you know, I was standing out at the site across from Tambo Mache, the Puku Pukara. Is it
Puku? Yeah.
And from that site, you get this great look out over the Andes and the mountains and the valley that goes down. And I remember sitting there talking with Will and just noticing the same thing that you just mentioned. It's just all the way up to the very tops of the mountains, that they're terraced. And if they're not being used anymore, you can still see where it was terraced. Even when they're overgrown and have right. trees over the whole side, you can still see those layers. And I have to absolutely agree with you is that I think that there was an ancient culture and the Incas came in later and they imitated what they saw. They saw that, oh, this must have worked. Look how extensively built out all of this is. Let's do that. You know, why would you not, like for the megalithic structures and buildings, why would you not use the base of those to build upon?
Right.
Makes total sense when you have something that's that stubby. Obviously, those things aren't going anywhere, right?
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, that was definitely another connecting thread for me with the Band of Holes was just the agricultural aspect. So,
right. Yeah. One thing I really was starting to dive deep in on this last trip there was just the ancient oral traditions. I think it's called the Legend of the Hanan Pacha, or the Three Worlds. And to me, there's something to this where, you know, and this is even in the Inca oral traditions, but again, the traditions go way back before them. But you got the Hanan Pacha, known as like the first culture. And even the Inca said these were the ones who shaped the bedrock, like all the precision shaping we see I found in the hills above Cusco, the biggest engineered sites like Sacsayhuaman. This would have been the Hanan Pacha. And this is also like considered the highest of three levels of consciousness in the Inca frame of mind. And it's also symbolized by the condor, which you see everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have all this 3D imagery. So that's like level one, the Hanan Pacha. Then you got level two, It's called the Urinpacha. And this is like the second culture. And I'm pulling a lot of this from some of our guides who are like, they have Inca ancestry, but they know the alternative history of Peru, right?
Right.
And so there's the Hunanpacha, the first culture, shaping the bedrock in the biggest sites. Then he had the Urinpacha come along later, who still had a lot of this knowledge, but they're the second culture, and they engineered the smaller sized precision walls like at the Coricancha, right? They're still precision and mortarless, but they look a lot different, right?
They do, yeah.
It's just smaller in scale, but precision. And in the Urinpacha, it's like the middle world, the mid-level of consciousness, and this is usually represented by the Puma, which is embedded everywhere.
Yep.
And then you got the third level. I think they call it the Ukinpacha. And this is where they believe, or at least my guide, that this was the Wari or the Inca cultures that came along, the third cultures, and built on top of the previous two. And that's where you see, you know, their Inca construction looks completely different. It's the stone, a rough stone and some clay mixed in, right? So it's like another world versus what you see on the bottom. Isn't that crazy?
It is. And, you know, I think definitely something that has stayed with me after going to so many different places around the world is that local tradition and a lot of times their religion, if we're calling them legends or stories or whatever, I've learned that I think it's fairly wise to assume that they are speaking literally. And I start from there and try to clear my head of anything that I've been taught thus far when it comes to modern day explanations, and work and allow my brain to work that way when I'm walking these sites. Because what I've found is it just makes so much more sense, you know, than anything else presented, at least in modern times, for a lot of places. So, you know, there's a clear progression of, not progression, but loss of understanding and technology as the years have gone by. As you go backwards, there's a progression of understanding and ability. And for anybody who's interested in stuff like this, seeing it in person is literal physical proof, which I think, you know, for anybody like us can be so exciting to see in person. And definitely one of the reasons why I feel like it is important to, if you can, to go look at some of these places in person, because it changes your perspective on the topics and different things. What I understand now is so much more, is not what I understood when I started. There's a clear difference from my first trip to Peru to the trip that I've gone now, with about 5 to 6 years in between the two.
Right.
And it's, Peru is just amazing. Almost more than any other site in the world. I think Peru probably has the most to offer in terms of potential secrets that can be unveiled about our past.
I would have to agree with you. I think that's Peru's probably that Cusco area, my favorite place on earth.
Yeah.
And I've only been there a handful of times, but cannot wait to go back this year. So I got to give a shameless plug for our upcoming Peru-Bolivia tour. This August, you can join me. I think it's August 1st through the 8th. The 12th. It's almost 2 weeks long. We're going to go to Peru and Bolivia. We're going to dip down there. We're going to see Pumapunku, Tiwanaku. we are going to dive into seeing these strange elongated skulls, and we're going to go to all the big sites that you've heard of or seen pictures of, Machu Picchu, Sacsayhuaman. But again, what makes our tour special is we're going to do what Michael just did in Peru, and we're going to kind of go off grid and see some of these sites that the normal tourist just wouldn't see, right? And so you can go to stargatevoyager.com/tours to get all the info, see the detailed itinerary, and you can get $500 off just for a little bit longer. And I think it will be the trip of a lifetime. And so I really hope to see you there. Check that out, stargatevoyager.com/tours. Am I lying, Michael? Is Peru worth going to?
Oh, yeah. And I love that you have Bolivia on there, because you're not just hyping up your trip. There aren't any other trips that where I think you can do as much as you're doing on that trip. To be able to see everything that you could see there in Cusco and do all these different things there in and around Cusco, and then still be able to make it down, visit Pumapunku and Tiwanaku, which are just amazing and incredible. That is such a treat. And anytime that you're able to get off trail, so to speak, and explore, that is so much fun. Especially when you come across something totally worth seeing that you know that tons of people haven't seen yet. That's such a rare opportunity these days, you know? So, but having all of that together in one trip is major. Pumapunku is, it's just incredible. It's on the same level of like, what? Like, how did they do this? And that whole area up there is just give yourself maybe a day or two to acclimate, because it'll kick your butt.
That'll help you, sure. Right? Well, on that same topic, because you'd mentioned how what you see in Bolivia at Pumapunku is so similar to what you see in Peru. Now let's take us to Easter Island, because you've been there.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know that there's at least one megalithic wall still left there. In ages past, there was megalithic walls all over, I believe. But tell us about your time on Easter Island and the wall, megalithic wall there, and your takeaways of seeing the evidence of this lost civilization there.
Easter Island is incredible, and it's not as hard to get to, I think, as it has a reputation for. It's an incredible place to visit. I will say that, you know, before I get into some of the details of the megaliths, just understand if you're going there that you have to pay a tour guide fee per day. You can't enter in any of the sites without a guide, and guides can cost. We were able to work a deal, but we're paying $150 a day for our guide, and most guides can be $200 and up, and that's per day per person. So if you're traveling there, that significantly increases your outgoing cost, right? And your budget.
They've got it going on in Easter Island.
So it is quite an expense just to go to the sites. But the megalithic wall there is at a site called Ahu Vanapi, if I remember correctly, Ahu. That was comparable. It's not a massive wall. It's megalithic, but it's not like a wall like Sacsayhuaman or something like that. It is still megalithic, and it is large. But I only say that to say that walking up on that wall there on Easter Island was so confusing. It was just kind of shocking, because Easter Island is the furthest out inhabited place in the world. You're like 2,500 miles away from the closest landmass, which is Chile. And there's this megalithic wall that looks exactly like worked stone walls in Peru, even down to the Have you seen that? I'm pretty sure I included a picture, but the walls that have the little small block fitted in and everything is just fitted so tight around that little tiny block. So you can find examples of that all over the world where megalithic structures exist. It really makes me, when I see those, it makes me think of Japanese woodworking, old Japanese woodworking, where they fit all of this stuff together and then they put that last little piece in and it just makes it all solid and connected. It's almost like it makes me think of that. But walking up on this megalithic wall that has so many different similarities, almost exactly, you could take this wall and you could put it in Peru and no one would blink. You wouldn't, you'd be like, yeah, that goes there. And it's just there at the edge of the island by the coast. And you turn around and there's the beach and the water right there. And it's incredible. And most people don't know that that's there. You know, obviously the Moai statues get all the attention. And probably rightfully so, they're incredible. And you can see the progression of work over the years, that there was a culture there that existed that advanced upon their technique. But that wall is it's simply incredible and absolutely worth seeing. So it's super close to the city there, the town. And probably the best thing you can do is, if you want to explore the town, you'll need a ride for your guide, which you have to provide as well. So, but you can get on just four-wheelers and drive all over the island, kind of scope it out and see different things and stuff. But you can't get right up on things without a guide with you. So you'll need a guide to go visit that site. But it is very close to the town, which makes it super doable. And it's just incredible.
I assume that they kind of probably have a mainstream narrative that they propagate there, the tour guides, of that this is all the stuff isn't all that old and that it's, you know, Polynesian made, correct?
Yeah. You know, a lot of the stories exist around these. So you know, I didn't hear really any good explanations for the wall. The best explanation that I heard, which I haven't been able to follow up with him, is a gentleman named Tony Trupp, I think, online, had shared something about a local legend, or a legend in Peru, if I remember correctly, of an ancient king sending like 40,000 warriors off over the seas to conquer islands. So in the direction of Easter Island in Indonesia. And, you know, if there's stories that date back far enough of something like that happened, well, you know, maybe perhaps they showed up with enough skill and whatever else to use the techniques from the area there in Peru. Because then if you take it even further, we go into Indonesia, you get into more megaliths. Is it Gunung Padang? Am I saying that right?
Yep.
And other places. And there's another site over there that's like on the islands. Guam has megaliths. So there's a, you know, and Peru, you know, Peru's pyramid of Corral dates back further than the pyramids of Egypt. So it's very possible that, you know, Peru has secrets that rewrite the entire narrative of our understanding of world history in a way that, you know, other sites around the world might not be able to do as much. Because clearly the wall there on the Easter Island is comparable to the megalithic walls and structures and stuff in Peru, without a doubt. I'd love to hear the argument against those two almost identical styles of working stone in separate places, you know, coming about on their own. But Easter Island's amazing. It's just another piece in the puzzle, I think. You know, it's an incredible place, incredible location. And you get, you know, go for a week if you go, and enjoy walking around looking at ancient stuff in paradise, basically.
Yeah. I did several years ago. I need to refresh it, but I did kind of an investigative series on Easter Island, and I've never been there yet. But from my research, I was kind of finding some oral traditions and legends again, like you. I like to pull from that. And I was stumbling upon, I found an old used book from Thor Heyerdahl, you know, who wrote the book Kon-Tiki, or he sailed all the way from Europe to Easter Island in a little raft. But he wrote a book on Easter Island, I think in the 70s, regarding his expeditions. And, you know, he wrote this before political correctness took over everything.
Right.
And so he's just laying out a bunch of the oral traditions he heard and read about and learned. And so a lot of the stuff I found was out of his book, which talked about this, again, kind of like the Hanan Pacha in Peru. Mm-hmm. There was an older civilization known as the Long Ears.
Long Ears.
The Long Ears, who were this elite ruling class. And again, I think they're connected to the builders of Peru, right?
Right.
And this earlier civilization likely actually built the biggest moai, and the biggest moai depicted them with these long ears, you know, mm-hmm. and that they also built the megalithic platforms like the one you're talking about. And it was the later short ear civilization. This would have been the Polynesians who came later, were basically, you know, again, building on top of and repurposing and trying to keep the moai production going, because you see the moai that are a lot smaller and they got the hats on, and so you see some differences. But what a fascinating place, to say the least. And so everybody go and make sure you subscribe to Michael's YouTube channel, Wandering Wolf. Again, follow him on X, Instagram, to see all these great photos and especially video and drone footage of this stuff. I know we're almost out of time, Michael. I want to ask you, let's finish this episode in the good old US of A. I wanted to ask you about the cart ruts in Texas and Coral Castle. So I'll let you take this wherever you want. What are you more passionate about talking about?
The cart ruts? Because I have upcoming stuff that I'm working on with that. And I'm based out of Austin. I grew up here. In fact, where the cart ruts are, when I was younger, we used to go down there and party and get into trouble. And I didn't, you know, what I was walking around and walking on. And now going back, there's two different sites here in the Austin area, in Austin and just north in Round Rock. I've documented that recently. And there are cart ruts on the Canary Islands and cart ruts in Malta. And so when I leave in a few weeks to go investigate further the agricultural techniques used on the Canary Islands for the Band of Holes, I'll be filming those cart ruts in the Canary Islands and in Malta as well. So really looking forward to grabbing comparisons between those sites. I'll be in Spain as well, and I believe there's stuff in Spain also. So it's going to be really interesting to be able to get more documentation from different sites around the world, get measurements. You have the Polycam now, and I've been trying to incorporate that into my filming process, and I've been forgetting. So hopefully I remember to do that, and I 3D image all these different sites, because that would be really useful to be able to do comparisons between Austin, Canary Islands, and Malta, and excited to be doing it, be able to do the comparisons, especially with a place that is in my hometown here that I can continue to follow up on. You know, in America, here in Austin, they're just explained away as grooves that were worn over time from carts and that created these ruts. And it just, you know, the explanations, the way, you know, the explaining away of stuff like this, you know, in history in America, it's just, you know, you take these cart ruts and you move them over to Malta, and they're attributed to ancient works. But anything that's here in America is explained away as whatever. And so it'd be great to be able to have some better information on some of this to share. So I'll be doing some measurements and making comparisons and getting quite a bit of video documentation.
Yeah, in Malta, it's explained as, man, this was some brilliant ancient architects, but in America, it's explained away as this was just some old cowboys.
Yeah, exactly. it's like the, I think I shared in with you the dolmen comparisons in, you know, the Balanced Rock up in New England dolmen. Well, what is, I mean, that, it looks exactly like these other dolmens found around the world, but it's a glacial erratic here.
Right. Yeah.
So this is just, you know, we have glaciers that are still retreating every year. This is in the world, and we don't have them being dropped off on pinpoint precision balanced three stones anywhere else, or anything like that. The glacial erratic theory is just,
oh, that is such a stretch. Such a stretch, it makes my brain hurt. But hey, I've got to ask you, since you're in Texas and you're looking into the ancient anomalies of Texas, have you heard and or seen these supposed ancient giant footprints that have been recently photographed and videoed in Texas?
I think I've seen that going around, but I haven't looked into it at all. So I'm not caught up on that now.
Okay. Yeah. Some of my friends on Instagram, Blurry Creatures, and then Giants of America or Giants of Ancient America. That's another account. The guy who owns that account has been down and photographed and videoed these. And I mean, dude, these are giant footprints that are in Texas. And I think they're next to dinosaur footprints too. So again, they're explained away as just, this was just kind of a large Native American. But it's crazy when you see the videos and you see the modern day foot next to these prints. You know what I'm saying?
Do you know where it's located?
Let me look it up. So let me see if I can find it. But isn't that wild that right there in Texas?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. We have mounds here. We have these cart ruts.
You've got rock wall, yeah. Rock
wall. You know, yeah, there's a lot going on out here. That's fun. And I've enjoyed spending a little bit more time stateside. In the last year or so, which has not been my focus for the majority of the time that I've been doing this and traveling. But I do feel like North America in the coming years is going to get a lot of attention here. Pretty soon. I think a lot of interest is going to start shifting to North America and places in North America over the coming years, and that we're going to start seeing some big stuff happening and entire narratives being thrown out and rewritten for history in North America in the coming years.
Well said.
I really believe that.
Yeah, I did know that. Well, I couldn't find out exactly where those footprints are, but I sent you the thing on Instagram there. So check that. But, man, Michael, thank you so much for your time. This has been awesome getting to know you and kind of hearing your story. And I'm really impressed with your travel itinerary. How many places do you go on average a year these days to do this?
I don't say no to anything. So I don't know. You know, it'll be March here pretty soon, and I'll have been in, I don't know, four different countries. And and I have more trips and travel planned up, but I try to travel as much as I can and be releasing content. And so it can vary, but quite a bit. It's quite a bit.
Awesome, man. Yeah. Well, how can people, any other ways people can follow you, keep up to date with you and everything you're doing and follow all your projects or subscribe in any way?
Yeah, definitely subscribe on YouTube. That's where I drop all my long form content, drone videos, walkthrough videos, my more in-depth videos. Twitter is going to be the best social media platform. When I'm traveling, I'll be dropping daily stuff on Twitter, so people can keep up with me in real time when I'm traveling, as long as I have a signal or Wi-Fi. And I am on all the other platforms, the Instagram, TikTok, Facebook. So it's WWOLFPROD on all platforms, except YouTube, Wandering Wolf. And yeah, I'll be working those theories that we talked about here, releasing content on that. I have a book release coming pretty soon.
Whoa, really?
This year. And I don't have a date for that release, but it'll be coming out this year. I just finished it just like this week.
Wow.
So excited to share that. And if you want to get on, know what my website is, it's wanderingwolfproductions.com, and that'll be getting updated real soon with a lot of stuff like the book release and different content there. So I definitely have a focus on getting the website up to be sharing all that information and stuff like that.
Sweet. And I'll try to link all of that in the bio from wherever you guys are watching or seeing this. So follow Michael on all those channels. Go to his website, and man, we'll be looking forward to this book release. You're just going to take over the world.
I appreciate that, man. And thank you so much for having me on. It's such a pleasure to connect. I've been such a huge fan for years watching your stuff and love what you do. So it's been an absolute pleasure to sit down and talk with you.
Hey, thanks so much, man. And we will do this hopefully in the future, and looking forward to the latest drops. So I'll be keeping a tab on your YouTube channel.
Awesome, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.